If it pleases the court, my name is Joe Siner, and I represent the appellant, the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And unlike the last case you just heard, which came before this court in an employment discrimination matter on summary judgment, this case actually comes before this court on a motion to dismiss. And the court, in granting that dismissal, disregarded the terms of the amended complaint, which alleged that since at least 2001, Concentra engaged in unlawful retaliation at its Elk Grove location in violation of Section 704A of Title VII. And the amended complaint, in addition to that, also provided that the company's illegal conduct included retaliation against Horn, the charging party in this case, after he opposed workplace conduct that he objectively and reasonably believed in good faith to violate Title VII. And the amended complaint also included that this conduct, that this was reported to the company's human resources director, and also stated that the retaliation encompassed issuing Horn unwarranted negative evaluations and resulted in his ultimate termination. The allegations in the amended complaint were therefore more than sufficient to provide notice to the defendant and to state a viable claim for retaliation under Title VII, and the district court clearly erred in dismissing the complaint. The federal rules are very clear, and they state that the complaint need only allege a short and plain statement of the claim showing that the EEOC, in this case, is entitled to relief, and that that standard was actually recently approved as recently as Monday by the Supreme Court in its Bell Atlantic decision, which we 28J'd to this court. This court has further clarified that the notice pleading requirement is a liberal standard and that the complaint need not contain a statement of the legal theory supporting the claim. I think that the EEOC's amended complaint in this case clearly satisfied these liberal pleading standards. The amended complaint provided notice to the defendant that the commission was alleging a retaliation claim pursuant to Title VII, set forth the time period that the violation occurred, indicated that the retaliation was a result of a complaint to the Director of Human Resources, and provided the nature of the company's illegal conduct. And I would just suggest that no more is required by the federal rules or by this court's case law or the case law of the Supreme Court.
Has Charles Horn changed his story at all since you filed the first complaint?
Unfortunately, Your Honor, we don't know. That's the only thing in the record. Discovery has not even begun in this case. There's not been a single deposition taken in this matter. And so all we have, and the commission would argue that the charge is not even properly before this court, that was improperly considered.
Well, you have no information currently that he has changed his story since the first complaint.
I mean, I personally don't have any information, but that it would not even be in the record, even if I did.
Well, if it's not in the record, you don't have the information.
That's
right?
That would be correct, Your Honor. And as I said, the district court also erred in considering the charge here, because the very narrow exception which is applied is that it's referred, the charge would need to be referred to in the complaint, which it was, but just to establish that the procedural requirements had been met, but also that the charge be central to the case. And we would suggest that the charge is in no way central to the commission's case in this matter. But even assuming that the charge were to be considered by this court, we think that it actually bolsters the commission's position here, because it really does provide a narrative of what happened in this case. And that was that the Concentra employee, Charles Horn, encountered his supervisor and his subordinate having sex on company property. And his supervisor later admitted to him that she was indeed having an affair with this individual, as well as with other company employees. And subsequently, he received complaints from several staff members that they believed that this individual was receiving preferential treatment because of this sexual relationship. And Horn subsequently, the charging party, subsequently reported this affair and his view that it was having adverse effects on the work environment and his ability to perform the job. And in response to this complaint, he was instructed by the area administrator not to complain to HR again. And after making this complaint and participating in Concentra's investigation into potential sexual harassment, he was issued unwarranted disciplinary action and ultimately fired. And he filed the charge of discrimination, not alleging sexual harassment in this case, but alleging retaliation for his involvement in Concentra's investigation into potential sexual harassment. And I think that distinction between actually alleging sexual harassment and retaliation is critical in this case. The court,
why?
Well, it's critical in the sense that this court has held that the individual doesn't have to prove the underlying conduct. He only needs to have a reasonable and good faith belief that it violated Title VII. So as long as the underlying conduct is not, as this court has said, utterly baseless or groundless, for him to believe that walking in on a supervisor having sex with a subordinate and receiving complaints about that, that that's not groundless to believe it resulted in a...
Are you now arguing that your first complaint should have been sustained? Is that...
We do believe that the first complaint should have been...
Well, I know you believe that, but is that what your argument is directed to now?
The first complaint is as if it never existed, Your Honor. It's functus officio. There was no response of pleading.
Well,
in this.
Why are you arguing it?
Because the defendants introduced the charge, and I'm just simply addressing. We do not believe that the charge is properly before this court. And if this court agrees with that, then I would suggest that indeed these facts should not be considered by this court, and that the amended complaint in and of itself is sufficient in this matter to state a claim under Title VII. And if there are no other questions at this time, I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Senator. Mr. Oh?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm James Oh. I'm representing the Appalachia Concentra Health Services in this matter. And the Supreme Court's decision from this past Monday in Bell Atlantic versus Twombly, I believe is how it's pronounced, is pretty timely. I think it's on point, and it augurs in favor of affirming the district court on the notice issue. The amended complaint, just looking at that complaint in isolation, without reference to the charge, without reference to the first complaint, stated that Mr. Horn allegedly opposed conduct that he objectively and reasonably believed in good faith violated Title VII. That was the operative statement in that complaint. And just looking at that complaint, at that statement, it did not provide sufficient notice to Concentra or to the district court of what the case was about. And
well, it indicated who he complained to, right?
True, it did.
And is that fact sufficient for the reader of the complaint to be able to determine what the complaint was all about?
Certainly not to the district court, Your Honor. And just identifying who the person complained to would require additional investigation and possibly take this into the realm of a motion for summary judgment if you wanted to dismiss right off the bat. And one of the purposes of 12b-6 is being able to dismiss complaints on their face that fail to state a claim. And I think that an excellent example of why that statement in the complaint is insufficient to provide notice is the Hamner case, where this court, held that a retaliation claim fails as a matter of law because the conduct that he opposed, harassment because of sexual orientation, is not under any circumstances prescribed by Title VII. So when you look at the First Amendment complaint, there's no way that the district court or Concentra could know, for example, was Mr. Horn complaining about harassment because of sexual orientation? Or was he complaining about anything else? And so I think it's pretty clear that the First Amendment complaint failed to set forth enough facts. We didn't argue for a heightened pleading standard. We didn't argue, as the EEOC claims, we did not argue that the EEOC had to plead a prima facie case of retaliation. And I think the district court got it exactly right that the complaint failed to provide adequate notice. Now,
Mr. O, would you say, having reviewed the pleading cases in recent years in this court that Bell would require us to reexamine?
Not at all. Actually, I believe Judge Bauer wrote the opinion in Phelan versus City of Chicago, and in that case, I think the holding was that the plaintiff must still plead sufficient facts to allow the district court to understand the gravamen of the complaint. And Twombly is very much consistent with that decision. And Phelan also came post Sverkevich, I think that's how you pronounce it, Supreme Court case from 2002, which struck down the Second Circuit, holding plaintiffs to a heightened pleading standard of having to plead a prima facie case of discrimination. But Twombly is very much consistent with the way the Seventh Circuit has interpreted Rule 8A2 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. Now, I think that the court could, on that grounds alone, affirm the district court. If Your Honors would like me to go into the question of whether or not the charge was central to the case, and therefore, if you consider the charge, it's clear that it was based on a complaint that's not prescribed by Title VII, I could go into that.
It's your time.
I'll briefly touch on it, Your Honor. It's clear that if the charge is considered, and I think it was properly considered by the district court because the EEOC engaged in, I think, what can be called generously artful pleading in the First Amendment complaint. And it's pretty clear that the one thing that Mr. Horn complained about was preference being given to a paramour. And it's very clear in this circuit's law that paramour preference is not prescribed by Title VII, and therefore a complaint premised on preference given to a paramour is not objectively reasonable and therefore not actionable.
Wolfowitz would be happy. Wolfowitz would be happy.
And so, Your Honors, I think on both grounds the district court got it right and should be affirmed. Thank you.
Mr. Senator? Thank you, Mr. O.
Thank you, Your Honors. I guess we just simply disagree and simply disagree about what Rule 8 requires, which is just simply a plain and concise statement showing that the pleader is entitled to relief. And I believe that under this court's precedent, indicating in Bennett, which I think is the best example, which states that I was turned down for a job because of my race, is all that a complaint has to say. And I would say that I was received unwarranted negative employment evaluations and was ultimately terminated because I was retaliated against in violation of Title VII. And in addition to that, providing who the complaint was to and what it resulted in would go above and beyond what this court requires.
Let me understand that, Mr. Senator. You're saying that second phrase is the equivalent of the first one, where the one where you referenced race?
I was turned down for a job because of my race. And again, it doesn't say what the race is. It doesn't say because I was black, Hispanic.
I appreciate that. And you're contrasting that with what phrasing in our case here?
That I received unwarranted negative evaluations and was terminated because I engaged in oppositional conduct in violation or retaliatory conduct that I believed in good faith to violate Title VII.
You don't think there's a vaguer component? I'm not saying an insufficient one, but a vaguer component in our case than the one which mentions race?
I really don't think so. I see it as the same, Your Honor. And the D.C. Circuit stated in its Roshan decision that I was retaliated against because I engaged in protected activity, which is even more vague than the statement that
I appreciate that, and I think until Monday I had some felt this circuit might even be more sympathetic than not, but I'm not sure your read of Bell Atlantic is as supportive as your 28J letter would say. I don't mean that by any way of criticism. I'm just wondering where the Supreme Court is pointing the possession arrow on this right now.
Well, we would suggest, obviously, Your Honor, that this complaint and the facts the many facts that it does allege and the claim that it does state is sufficient under Bell Atlantic and this court's case law. To the extent that this court views that that is not the case and that Bell Atlantic somehow changed the landscape, we would suggest that at a minimum and in the interest of justice that the that this order would be vacated and that we would have an opportunity to replead the case.
Well, it certainly caused us to have some reflection.
If there are no further questions, that is all that I have. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.